Support for WPR comes from Stafford Rosenbaum, a Wisconsin-based law firm celebrating 145 years of commitment to practical legal solutions in areas such as family law and estate planning. StaffordLaw.com.
While Americans celebrate Irish culture today, St. Patrick's Day, it hasn't always been that way. Irish immigrants faced the same hardships and stigmas as many other immigrants in the U.S., maybe worse than most.
You can join our conversation about immigration in the United States. Do you have stories from immigrant ancestors to share, Irish or otherwise? And if you're an immigrant yourself, what are some of the hardest things about adapting to life in the United States? Call in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
We'll bring on Jonathan Pollack now. He's a history instructor at Madison College. He joins us each month to give some historical perspective on the news and events of the day. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to be on.
Well, a lot of immigrant groups, as I said up front, have had tough times in the country. No secret there. It seems as though, at least among European immigrants, people from Ireland were particularly looked down on. Am I right about that?
Well, at certain points in the history, absolutely. One of the things that's kind of fascinating about Irish immigration is that it's the Irish were here from the start. When you're looking at people who came to the U.S. when it was still British colonies, you've got a large segment of people who came from Ulster, from Northern Ireland, who came over. And as far as we can tell, the first mentions of St. Patrick's Day observance in the United States came about as a result of these Scots-Irish groups from Northern Ireland. So from there, from being present at the beginning of the Republic, the character of Irish immigration began to change in the early 19th century. Beginning in the 1820s and really accelerating through the 1830s and 40s is when Irish immigrants from the southern two-thirds of the island, from what we now know as the Republic of Ireland, started coming over in large numbers and really changed the character of Irish immigration. These later Irish generations, beginning in the 1830s and 40s, are the ones who, came in at, doing the kind of jobs that no one else wanted to do, often coming over in a really impoverished situation as a result of famine and as a result of British policies that had kept Ireland as this early British colony. And it's that group that we think of as having these hardships that paved the way for other difficult transitions to come.
When you mentioned the Scots-Irish from the Ulster region, I'm imagining mostly Protestant Irish?
Yeah, they were Protestant, but they still St. Patrick still was the patron saint of Ireland, whether Protestant or Catholic.
But was the Catholic identity of that wave of Irish immigration that, as you mentioned, started in the 1820s, was that part of the negative reaction from Protestant mainstream America at the time?
Yeah, so it's at the very beginning there really wasn't that kind of hostile reaction. It's really after about 1850 that you get the growth of nativism in America. That you get anti-Catholic movements, anti-Masonic movements. You get a group known as the American Party, which people called the Know-Nothings, because their sort of watchword to each other was it was kind of like Fight Club. If anybody asked about the American Party or if you were a member of the American Party, the proper answer was, I don't know anything about that.
The Sergeant Schultz rule.
Yeah.
I know nothing.
Exactly. Right. So that was they were kind of a secret society and party, and they organized that way because members of the Know-Nothing Party saw Irish immigrants as part of a grand conspiracy, part of a Catholic conspiracy to undermine the United States. And so at that point, anti-Catholicism really kind of ramped up in America.
Why then?
Well, I think the reason was that especially in cities along the East Coast, cities in the Northeast, ranging from Baltimore roughly up to as far north as like Portland, Maine, there's a large influx of people from one part of Europe. And when you've got a large influx of people coming in from one area, observing, in this case, Catholicism, which had been kind of a minority faith in America, which is, as you pointed out, was mainly Protestant, that once you get a critical mass of people, that's when native-born Americans began wondering, wait a minute, the fundamental character of the country is changing. It's not the America it used to be. And perhaps that's something to be alarmed about. When there were a few Irish Catholics around and then when they were joined by a few German Catholics, a few British Catholics and so forth, they were just sort of part of the mix. They didn't really stand out. But as the numbers grew in the 1840s, by the 1850s, there was an idea that this was something dangerous that threatened the United States. As a result of this, Irish mutual aid societies, most notably the Ancient Order of Hibernians, who still direct St. Patrick's Day parades in New York and Boston and elsewhere, They really mobilized St. Patrick's Day as a way of proclaiming their citizenship. In the publicity about St. Patrick's Day from the 1850s, records of the banners that people carried and things like that, St. Patrick's Day marchers affirmed that they were Irish citizens of the United States. And so this idea of citizenship and putting that on public display, going down often the main streets of a city, was a way to try to put those fears at ease, were a way to try to blend Irishness and Americanism.
It was another source of friction, maybe something brought over from the old country, tensions within Ireland or between Ireland and the Ulster region, or between English and Scottish and the Irish.
Yeah, well, the tensions between the Ulster region, I think, were more pronounced into the 20th century after the battles in Ireland really picked up in the early 20th century, although actually in the late 19th century, there's some of that also. In the mid-19th century, there's still mainstream American society, Protestant American society, still identified very openly with England. And so for the Irish to come to America, they initially saw this as a way to break away from England, to stop being so submerged in Englishness. And when native-born Americans kind of embraced English culture and saw themselves as cousins to the English and having this special relationship with England and so forth, I think St. Patrick's Day and this public declaration of Irishness was a way of saying, well, we're Irish and therefore American, and trying to tie in the history of Ireland with the history of the United States as two peoples who at one point in time or another, or were in a state of perpetual revolt against England, toward claiming a new and independent identity.
What you're talking about with St. Patrick's Day as a way to try to navigate that immigrant identity, and that story happens again and again with group after group as we get these different waves of immigration. Are the Irish a template for later immigrants to come?
I think that's an excellent point. Lots of scholars kind of looked at this from different angles, from the point of view of ethnicity, as you talked about. In some ways, I'd argue that the Irish were kind of the prototypical ethnic group, especially ethnic group in a large city. Here in Wisconsin, where our state's heritage is so tied up in German and Scandinavian communities scattered around all over the state, things look a little different. But in larger cities, yeah, the other groups that followed in the footsteps of the Irish established mutual aid societies so that people coming from whichever country could go to a society named after a patron saint or associated with a certain district or city, and know they'd find people who spoke their language, know people who observed their religion, know people who would possibly line them up with jobs and help them get patched into life in their new country. The rise of Italian Americans, another large Catholic group coming over in the late 19th century, I think owes a lot to the Irish example before them, that public displays of Italianness resembled, I think, in a lot of ways, public displays of Irishness a generation or two before.
And their own holiday, too, with Columbus Day.
Yeah. Well, and Columbus Day is an interesting one because Columbus Day was kind of around but really became a big deal in the late 19th century. The Knights of Columbus, originally an Irish mutual aid society, were the ones to kind of seize on it. But what the Knights of Columbus did was they were out to try to unify American Catholics around an Irish model. In the 19th century, of course, people were really attached to their national churches, their national parishes, and so forth. The Knights of Columbus, as an Irish group, and the Irish being the largest Catholic ethnic group in the U.S., tried to sort of keep everyone Irish, but as Italians came over, and as Italians seized on Columbus's birth in Genoa, which became part of Italy, by the 1920s, Columbus Day and everything Columbus was kind of shorthand for Italian. So it's kind of an interesting way of looking at Columbus, a holiday we can tackle on in October, that his holiday also became this Americanness thing.
We're talking about Irish immigration in the United States and how it compared to other immigrant groups, too. Madison College history instructor John Pollock is with us.
And you can join the conversation. Do you have immigration stories to share? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. We continue our conversation about Irish immigration in the United States. While America celebrates Irish culture today, it wasn't always that way. Madison College history instructor John Pollock is with us.
And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts or questions about Irish immigration in the United States? Do you have a story, maybe an old family story about your ancestors, something you came across doing genealogy about Irish ancestors or other people who went through the immigrant experience here? 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can email talk@WPR.org. John, I wanted to ask you about indentured servitude. I hear about that when I hear about Irish immigrants in the United States. Was that a big deal? Where did that fit in?
Well, a bigger deal. Irish immigrants and indentured servitude is largely an earlier phenomenon that during the 1700s, 1600s and 1700s, actually, as England was looking for people to move out and settle and work on the farms of the new nation, of the new colonies. Lots of Northern Irish, lots of Scots Irish answered that call. They had come down into London looking for work, finding none. Indentured servitude in Virginia or the Carolinas looked like a good idea. By the time of the large-scale Irish Catholic immigration in the 19th century, indentured servitude had pretty much been replaced by slavery across the southern United States, although the Irish who came over to the U.S. during that time often were occupying the bottom rung of the economic ladder, sweeping streets, doing menial jobs, as I mentioned, that other people born here didn't want to do. Usually indentured servitude was not really a thing in the U.S. in the 19th century.
I want to get a sense of how much hatred there was or antipathy toward Irish immigrants there was, a scene in Blazing Saddles, of all things. I'm going to clean up the ethnic language here a little bit, but the townspeople say, we'll let the African-Americans move here, we'll let the Chinese-Americans move here, but we won't take the Irish at first. Was there really that much scorn for them?
That's a slight exaggeration. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd say that the Irish, there's definitely, I mean, there's an old song called No Irish Need Apply, and that sign would have appeared in businesses in New York City, in Boston, and other cities with large newly arrived Irish populations. But in a lot of cases, Irish immigrants and African Americans were treated at about the same economic level. And there's actually been quite a bit of scholarship on that, how the Irish managed to sort of join forces with the people who had been kind of putting them down and shared that oppression toward African Americans. Martin Scorsese's Gangs in New York, which I thought was the movie reference you were going to make there, that movie illustrates that to some extent during the 1860s, during the Civil War. Where Irish and black New Yorkers, even though they lived in the same neighborhoods, sort of turned against each other. So the Irish were a stigmatized group of several. But I think that was also kind of localized. I mean, the Irish who made it out here to the Midwest didn't suffer that same degree of exclusion and so forth. My sense is it was relatively short-lived. It was a generation or two. And then through efforts like the Ancient Order of Hibernians, through the Catholic Church, through their use of English was one of the things that I think helped the Irish assimilate faster than, say, Italian Americans a generation or two later, that the Irish managed to escape a lot of that stigma. And I think in the case of Blazing Saddles, Mel Brooks is bringing that up for humorous effect.
Hmm. We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have David with us in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hey, I just wanted to see once if the doctor could just go and maybe touch on the difference between the Catholicism in the Republic of Ireland and Protestantism in Northern Ireland, which, you know, some people still to this day don't consider part of Ireland. If you take a look at the dynamic of the oppression that took place based upon the religious context, could you get into some ideas on that, Doctor?
I think in England, one of the differences in the Irish experience versus the experience of Irish immigrants to the United States, whether Protestant or Catholic, is that you don't have an established church. That one of the big factors in really ramping up Irish Catholic resentment of the British was, number one, running Ireland as a colony for hundreds of years and really, you know, marginalizing the Irish and trying to force them to become Protestant and so forth. And even when the force wasn't that direct, the Irish were still paying taxes to the Church of England. Mm-hmm. And in the United States, there's no established church. There's no tax that you're paying to any particular denomination. So I think that led to less of that oppression over here. In the United States also, through the figure of St. Patrick, arguably, and also through the fact that in the U.S., the Scots-Irish and the Irish Catholics tended not to live in the same areas as much. There wasn't as much contact between them as you'd find, as the caller points out, in Northern Ireland, where you had Irish and Catholic settlements right next to each other and, you know, joining neighborhoods in the same cities and so forth. In the United States, Scots-Irish had been here longer. They had, by the time large numbers of Catholic-Irish immigrants started arriving, they had kind of withdrawn from that identity somewhat. That was not the Scots-Irish identity didn't hang on in the U.S. as long as the Irish Catholic identity did. As a result, the kind of strife that went on in Ireland through the 19th and the 20th centuries and is finally now seemed to be ebbing just wasn't a factor in the U.S.
So at some point we went from, you know, some hostility toward this large group of Catholic immigrants to now, where most of us are putting on green today and celebrating St. Patrick's Day, in many cases, whether we have any Irish in us at all. How did that happen?
St. Patrick's Day observances in large cities are, it's a parade. You know, streets shut down. The normal order of business comes to a standstill. Even back in the mid-19th century, St. Patrick's Day parades were people who weren't taking part of them found it like needlessly epic. It was too big. It went on for blocks and blocks, and it took forever for people to pass the reviewing stands and get on with the normal day. So St. Patrick's Day, from that big city example, has become sort of a generalized day off. That in cities that have a big parade on the day itself, people turn out, they leave work, they watch the parade. After all, it's not like you're going to get a courier through there. You're not going to be able to drive or anything like that. So you might as well watch the parade and celebrate. And I think it's kind of taken off from there. I mean, there are a number of holidays that now exist as excuses to go out and get loaded. St. Patrick's Day took that on, even though Irish temperance societies were very active in St. Patrick's Day parades. In the 19th century, they lost that battle eventually. But St. Patrick's Day has spawned Cinco de Mayo, which is a big holiday in the Puebla state of southern Mexico. Not as big a deal everywhere else, but Cinco de Mayo has become a holiday promoted by beer companies as a day to drink large quantities of Mexican beer and so forth. So it seems like St. Patrick's Day led that kind of set that kind of precedent of American festival days. Somewhat connected to, but ultimately divorced from, the original purpose.
Right. So people from the mother country wouldn't recognize those events in many cases.
Right. Yeah. It's really only in the 1990s that Ireland has had St. Patrick's Day parades on the scale of St. Patrick's Day parades in the United States.
And the politicization of these events hasn't ended. We, every year, this year included, see debates about St. Patrick's Day parades and bans on gay organizations marching in them, and then politicians having to decide, am I going to march in this parade? That's been a tradition for politicians. Am I going to make a political point? Who am I going to offend today?
Yeah, and I think that comes down to sort of a tension in there about St. Patrick's Day parades representing Irish culture or St. Patrick's Day representing Catholicism, that the Catholic Church over the last several decades at least has been this kind of force for political conservatism in the United States. And therefore, through that ideology, outwardly, you know, out gay groups are most certainly unwelcome. At the same time, St. Patrick's Day also has this history of people from all over Ireland participating. Again, as I mentioned back from the beginning, Scots-Irish marchers being in there along with Irish Catholic marchers. So in that sense, you've got people who are claiming Irish identity. They feel entitled to march. It's a huge and ongoing tension.
Are you doing anything to celebrate St. Patrick's Day?
Well, actually, it's my wife's birthday today. And so our tradition is going to any place that's not likely to be celebrating St. Patrick's Day so we can have a quiet birthday dinner without the revelry.
All right, John, I've learned a lot. As always, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
That was Jonathan Pollock, history instructor at Madison College.